Okay, welcome to session 325 of the 2005 Sunstone Symposium. And my name is Devery Anderson, chairing this session. And as per the chair instructions here, I just need to remind you, if you have cell phones or pagers, please turn them off. And if you're in doubt at all, please check to make sure that they are off, because they seem to go off anyway, despite the announcements. The title of the session today is The Authoritarian Temptation. It's a paper presented by Francis Nelson Henderson. And to introduce the speakers, it's a response to from Sonia Farnsworth. And Francis Nelson Henderson was born in the church in Raleigh, North Carolina, served a mission to Southern California from 1962 to 64, and graduated with a BA in physics from BYU in 1968. Also was married in the temple, founding member of Comtel 1978. That was founded a satellite communications company, and also sponsors the Mormon Alliance website. And responding to Francis Nelson today is, Francis Henderson today is Sonia Farnsworth, who has a master's in speech communication from San Jose State, is also an instructor of communication theory and writing at the University of Phoenix in Salt Lake City. So we'll proceed with the paper and then the response, and we'll take questions after that.
The Authoritarian Temptation, Executive Summary. Authoritarianism is tempting because it is efficient and because of its ability to impose order. However, absent an effective pluralism to hold it in check, it is by nature abusive. This paper argues that members of the church are responsible by force of popular will, one person at a time, to produce a pluralistic society where differing views compete for influence. Key to such a correction is that members lay claim to their individual freedom and power. In the contemporary struggle for human rights, the dividing line in that struggle is whether a particular society allows or bans the right of dissent. In the case for democracy, the power of freedom to overcome terror, Nathan Sharansky points out that the right to dissent is more important than the content of dissent. Mormon church prohibitions and sanctions against public dissent violate the right to freedom of speech of its members and offend their dignity and worth. Absent a democratic constitution or bill of rights, church members need a social contract of their own making between themselves and the church, not just a one-way commitment from themselves given to the church. These contracts require a reciprocal commitment from a church to its members of complete honesty, the exercise of no other power but love, and the protection of individual freedom above the self-interest of the church. I will point out during this paper specific rights you may wish to hold and reserve to yourself in your own customized social contract of sorts. Authoritarianism works inherently to defeat the inner development of the fully empowered individual. I will, to support this case, I will discuss the following. First, I will contrast democratic, totalitarian, and authoritarian organizations and give Latter-day Saint examples. Second, I will discuss power, the use of coercion, truth claims, and promises in the struggle to impose the mind of one or that of an organization upon the mind of another. Third, I will discuss the collusion of church members with the victory of authoritarianism over the freedom of speech and self-determination. Fourth and finally, I ask church members to claim their freedom by speaking out publicly in order to change the balance of power between the individual and the church, thus making the church a more democratic organization, more respectful of the rights and needs of its members. To be an individual is important, and that loneliness has to be braved. A liberal democracy. According to the encyclopedia, a liberal democracy is a form of government where people have power over decision makers. In the United States, a Constitution and Bill of Rights form a social contract, protecting individual liberties and the rights of minorities in society, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, citizens informed of their rights and responsibilities, and the right to privacy, as well as equality before the law and due process under the law, and more. Such constitutional rights, also named liberal rights, prohibit the will of the majority from unjustly violating the rights of individuals and minorities. A key concept developed by John Locke in the 1700s holds that individuals should be allowed complete freedom of action as long as they do not infringe on the freedoms of others. I am calling attention here to the formation of your social contract. You may wish to require of your church that it no longer infringe or threaten to infringe on your individual freedoms. In spite of the authoritarian stance of Mormonism today, I taught a young adults class from the improvement from a Mutual Improvement Association manual written during the presidency of David O. McKay that supported democratic ideals and liberties in the church. It said, "The democratic spirit is consistent with the spirit, teachings, and purpose of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Dictatorial methods anywhere, in the state, church, family, or school, will crush or greatly limit man's creative thinking. Creation presupposes freedom." The lesson goes on to say, "In a democratic situation, man senses his dignity. He is recognized for his inherent worth as a man among men." Voltaire's right of communication is also quoted. "I do not agree with a word that you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it." The MIA lesson offers Latter-day Saints' 11th Article of Faith to back up the point of one holding both a strong conviction and yet being tolerant. "We claim the privilege of worshiping Almighty God according to the dictates of our own conscience and allow all men the same privilege. Let them worship how, where, or when they may." Hopefully this would include church members as well. However, following the period of liberal church president David O. McKay, when this lesson material was written, the church took a hard turn back towards authoritarianism. Women could not offer sacrament meeting prayer, and men undergoing a vasectomy were disqualified for temple recommends under President Joseph Fielding Smith. Under President Harold B. Lee, the Correlation Committee began its long service as a tool of a conservative convergence. Under President Spencer W. Kimball, family planning was opposed, saying marital sexual intercourse could occur only at the hazard of pregnancy. More recently, prominent church leader Apostle Boyd K. Packer denies that there is any such thing as a democratic loyal opposition in Mormonism. Due to time constraints, I skip communitarianism, collectivism, individualism, and the anarchist. Before skipping to totalitarianism, it is worth noting that Mormonism experimented with an egalitarian form of collectivism called the United Order. Totalitarianism. Totalitarian societies prohibit activities contrary to the goals of its leaders. They maintain power through propaganda and suppression of open criticism. They exploit real and imaginary threats as threats to the people and as excuses for persecution of dissidents and other enemies of the people. In a totalitarian system, the ruling ideology requires that every aspect of an individual's life become subordinated to the survival of the system. The popular will is manipulated by propaganda and suppression of free speech. Totalitarian systems frequently have a charismatic leader, but they don't require one. Whether a newly installed leader possesses natural charisma or not, the totalitarian system acts as if the leader does possess it. In a Mormon example, Joseph Smith commonly referred to any criticism for any reason by Mormons or non-Mormons as persecution. When the Nauvoo Expositor newspaper was founded to oppose his secret polygamy, he and the Nauvoo City Council ordered the press smashed. However, it printed the truth, not slander. This act remains unrenounced. Authoritarianism. According, again, to the encyclopedia, authoritarian is a concentration of power in a leader or an elite not constitutionally responsible to the people, favoring blind submission. Authoritarianism arises from the governing body's presumption that they know what is right or wrong for the individual, and thus is intolerant of dissent. The organization then enforces its right, what it thinks is right, and often does so coercively. Dissenting voices are ignored, or more strikingly, they are considered to be plotting against the best interest of the people. The Roman Catholic Church can be accurately described as authoritarian. In modern times, it is not totalitarian because it lacks the means to use physical force to enforce its edicts. Authoritarian power often commands popular support, such that the leader may claim that his rule is democratic. This is achieved through a combination of ideology with its promise of security and future utopia, as well as a daily dose of perpetual indoctrination. And without the checks and balances of a diffuse pluralistic decision-making, a real possibility of mass manipulation results. In fact, members of a complex society may demand that the problems of modern life be dealt with centrally. Indeed, Mormonism's governing body does presume to know what is right and wrong for all its members, men and women. It uses church resources and organization in attempts to impose by force of state and national laws its beliefs onto its citizens on issues such as the equal rights of women, the sexual rights of consenting adults, gay and lesbian civil unions. Although its leadership lives protected in Utah in a liberal democracy that protects freedom of speech and public expression, it is itself at the same time intolerant of public dissent, as in the excommunication of Janice Allred for speaking her views publicly on the rights and power of women in the church. As is characteristic of authoritarian tendencies towards control of information, Mormonism prohibits critical examination of its truth claims and undermines intellectual honesty, as in the treatment of BYU professor David P. Wright, who applied his training in the method of historical criticism to the Book of Mormon. He was excommunicated for publishing his results, which concluded, "A critical study of the Book of Mormon shows that Joseph Smith was its author. The lengthy and gripping account is posted at the Mormon Alliance website, Volume 3, Part 5, in which Dr. Wright writes to his bishop, 'The problems I have addressed with regard to the Book of Mormon and other scriptural works were and are real and required and still require rigorous logical answers. My excommunication will give only a brief illusory satisfaction that the problems have been addressed. Dr. Wright had also suggested Latter-day Saints hold unfounded notions that are injurious to Native Americans. On the dome of the Jefferson Memorial are inscribed the words, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility to every form of tyranny over the mind of man." Yes, the authoritarians in control of the Mormon Church do use excommunication or the threat of it to intimidate and control church members. However, difference of ideas in the mind of man cannot be the basis of separation among God's children. Indeed, to the Democrat, Libertarian, or Individualist, such authoritarian acts of excommunication are inherently illegitimate because they subordinate the dignity of the individual by denying the right to freedom of speech. I call attention to a key addition to your social contract. You may wish to claim the right to freedom of speech. Right or wrong, to say or to advocate publicly your religious opinion. There are those of us who, when newly encountering an authoritarian system or living comfortably in one, feel that we have found our home, feel inspired as though we have finally found that which we have always been searching for, the certainty of knowing, the truth, the uniformity, the order, the safety, the unquestioning, the guidance from above. The belonging to an obedient society can feel so obviously natural and right, even divine. However, such comfort tempts the individual to relinquish their individuality and the important freedoms that I am describing. Power. The source of power and the use of power, either coercive or persuasive, identify the organizational type more than any other single attribute. Hence the necessity of discussing coercion, force, pressure in a religious context. The concept of coercion is broadly defined here to include not only the threat of physical force in compelling a person to act, but also the threat of moral force, or duress, or reprisal, as discharging from employment, or controlling the flow of information, or creating a perceived threat, or controlling the circumstances of a person so that, to avoid a perceived greater evil, the person is compelled to act not in a voluntary plan of one's own, but to serve the intentions of another, even if those intentions are noble. Coercion is not the use of actual force, but is the threat or the fear of a perceived harm that is used to gain compliance. Power comprises anything that establishes and maintains control of one person over another. Thus, power covers all religious and social relationships which serve the end of a person or an organization to control another, from physical violence to the most subtle psychological ties by which one mind controls another. How do we know? This is quite different from acting as if we know, which can be a demonstration of faith. We should recognize the virtue of our uncertainty, our not knowing. We surely and authentically. In psychological coercion, the threatened injury is in regards to the victim's relationship with other people. The most obvious example is blackmail, where the threat consists of disseminating information that's harmful to a person's reputation. But many other cases are possible, including purposeful threats of rejection from or disapproval by a peer group, or even mere anger or displeasure by a loved one. Mormon examples of rejection are rejection or expulsion from one's religious community, otherwise known as disfellowship or excommunication. Such discipline may disrupt families or produce divorce. In Utah and other densely populated Mormon communities, church discipline may be accompanied by the prejudice of neighbors or economic harm in the workplace. Even more seriously to believing Latter-day Saints, excommunication is perceived to threaten their eternal well-being, the highest purpose of their mortal lives, and hence the protection of one's status in the religious community is perceived to be of eternal importance. Mormonism experiences a kind of ideological or thought coercion, in which its ideology cannot be publicly challenged or questioned on threat of excommunication. The individual faces a perpetual stream of church meetings, group classes, testimony meetings, temple attendance, in which the highest purpose is to strengthen religious certainty or testimony. The only two choices offered are either accept the ideology or silence, prayer, and repentance until one is worthy to accept. Non-acceptance is not an offered option. Self-censorship is widely practiced as church members and church employees become more finely attuned to what is acceptable. For example, members are generally compliant to church instructions as to what is proper content and what is not when they speak their testimony. Disciplinary coercion is used as the main coordination tool of command systems, such as a military organization. Each individual member is typically forced into altruistic behavior in the interest of the whole group. In Mormonism, the command system is illustrated by the practice of making every boy and man into an officer of the church, i.e., a member of the priesthood. And thus, the chain of command is established between most male members and their church leadership. However, which hat is the member wearing? His personhood hat or his priesthood hat? Is not the boy's individuality trumped by his high priesthood office? Does the boy priest conceptually recognize the separation between himself and the church? If so, which should he put first? Which is he taught to put first? If the church command system has established in his mind that his priesthood is over personhood, then command coercion is at work. In the law of contracts, the contract is void when coercion, duress, or unfair persuasion is used to procure an agreement. This concept may give pause to Latter-day Saints who have entered into their secret temple covenants without a full and advanced disclosure. Otherwise, since these covenants are normally first taken at rites of passage, such as temple marriage or missionary service, without advanced foreknowledge, the decision to take these covenants may be pressured or coercive. At common law, one who is coerced may be excused from accountability for one's actions or may have one's contract nullified. This concept of accountability may also give pause to Latter-day Saints whose very obedient actions are compelled by religious pressures and fears. Though obedient, the resultant quality of inauthenticity can nullify the moral virtue of one's actions. The Taking Children Seriously movement attempts to extend the concept of coercion to include the relationship between parents and children. It holds it is possible and desirable to act in such a way with a child that all activities are consensual. I call attention to two additions to your social contract. First, you may wish your relationship to the church to be adult to adult, not parent to child. And second, you may wish your relationship to the church to be consensual, not coercive. The coercive power of truth claims. As an adolescent in sacrament meeting, I wondered, what made the church unique? Was it about having the truth, or was it about the community of people? I went with truth. So too it is in the minds of many church members. Paraphrasing comments from a member, today the recent proclamation from the apostles and prophets was passed out in sacrament meeting about their authority coming directly from Jesus Christ. And if a church has that truth, then end of discussion. Authoritarian apostle Boyd K. Packer has charged LDS historians to tell a faith-promoting history demonstrating that the hand of the Lord has been in every hour and in every moment of the church from its beginning until now. This faithful history policy is in itself alone a violation of trust. This policy has a long tradition. As a young married man, I was horrified when the authoritarians in church leadership set about reversing the libertarian principles I was taught and deeply believed. From the time of Church President David O. McKay and his counselor, Hugh B. Brown, this crisis provoked me to more widely examine my church and its history. I was resolved in my stance on human liberty, be it government or church. I had always expected Joseph Smith's claims would be strengthened by the passage of time. However, upon my close examination of the church and its history as an adult, the scope of the collapse remains shocking to me. During my investigation, I slowly came to the astonishing conclusion that most of what I had been taught my entire life by my church leaders, comprising my entire faith foundation, was probably false and certainly misleading. I skip examples for lack of time here. They're on page 15 and 16 in the text. If you want to get copies afterwards, they're up here on the table. Also available on the web. The church is not justified in telling its story as it does to people who trust it completely. Dallin Oaks' indication that the church has no duty to tell both sides of the story is simply wrong. Members are led to believe church leaders are looking after their interest. And so leaders have put themselves in a position analogous to, if not in fact, that of a trustee. While the church is soliciting contributions of time and money, one wonders if the misrepresentations produced by its faithful history policy could result in a class action lawsuit. I call attention to several additions to your social contract. You may wish to require a church policy of full disclosure, openness, and a best effort at an objective and honest history. An error in perception can result in an unintended coercion. As Ashley Brilliant puts it, if you don't like how I sound, the trouble might be with how you are listening. However, authoritarians in the church have made their intentions crystal clear by the excommunication of teachers, historians, writers, intellectuals, feminists, whose public speaking and writing differs from the beliefs of church leaders. These acts are acts of spiritual abuse. They are unchristlike and unbecoming of a church. Public renunciation of these acts and restoration of membership to all who have suffered from them are needed in order to clearly remove the implied threat of excommunication from the minds of all church members. The truth claims must be seen for what they are. They are an act of being right. Being right is always an attempt at control. Hence, it is an unholy claim to power. The claim is false on the face of it, if only because it was made and without further appeal to its content or to church history or to doctrine. I believe more relevant is to look at the nature of the church today. These questions need not go back 165 years. Is it honest with me? Does it wish to define my life for me, or does it encourage my own self-determination? Is it domineering, manipulative, or controlling? Does it make its institutional needs, its image, its measures of its own well-being more important than the needs of its individual members? Does it respect my time? Will it reveal itself to me openly? Will it give me all the information that it has and trust me to make up my own mind? Does it encourage open debate? Will it respect that my individual freedoms are never consigned to it? Does it respect me as an individual, my loves, my interest, my human nature, my sexuality, my personhood? Is it quick to see and to correct social injustice? Does it see God's love as unconditional? Is it first to see and to publicly acknowledge its mistakes? Will church leaders accept public criticism? Complicity. Church members are in deep collusion with the victory of authoritarianism. As Eric Fromm explains in his book, Escape from Freedom, I was stunned the first time I read Fromm's description of submission and the authoritarian character, as if to say, how kind of you to want to live my life for me. The Mormon authoritarian character would probably disagree that there is an escape from freedom and responsibility, because one may consciously conceive of oneself as free and subject only to oneself. However, that this escape has indeed occurred is illustrated first by the total absence of financial accountability for tithing required by the contributing membership of their church leadership. That no lay tithe payers require or are provided this information is shocking. Or that the tithe payer feels no authorization to decide for themselves whether or not they should pay. Secondly, the faithful Mormon authoritarian character will say their individual freedom and autonomy are fundamental religious precepts. Yet they are silent about or supportive of the forceful repression of freedom of speech, as when church women are excommunicated for publicly expressing their opposing views about the place of women in the church. Even among the Mormon intelligentsia, this culture of silence is justified as the Mormon way. However, by this loyalty to authority, the development of one's character is stunted. Normally, love is based on freedom and an equality of power. But in the authoritarian system, the meaning of love, I'm not going to make it, and self-love are confronted by submission. An attitude of self-denial for the sake of communal unity and the surrender of one's own rights and power are perceived as examples of great love, duty, and devotion. However, just the opposite is true, in that loyalty and obedience are placed ahead of self-trust, because love, self-interest, rather than self-denial, are the essential affirmations of one's own life, happiness, growth, freedom, purpose, and worth. Likewise, the teaching of sacrifice is a perversion of true sacrifice if the individual self is in submission to the higher power of an authoritarian system. Rather, sacrifice has moral authority only when individuals act freely and in the sense of spontaneity, acknowledging no higher authority than from within oneself. Indeed, one of the most obvious losses of individual self within Mormonism is the submission of endowed temple-goers to the church laws of obedience and sacrifice. What have the iron rotters got right? They know they have won. Iron rotters own the church. Liahonas typically don't even recognize there is a contest. Iron rotters have the intellectual honesty to know that Joseph Smith founded the church on his truth claims. It seems to me Liahonas dishonestly cop out, especially the smartest ones. By failing to confront their internal dissidence for what it is, and instead by redefining the fundamental truth claims of the church as non-literal, symbolic, or revelatory, despite the direct contradiction to the intent of Joseph Smith's representations. However, what is required is not a redefinition, but a renunciation of the original authoritarian principles and claims to power, followed by a new religious foundation to rise out of a new openness and intellectual freedom. Who communicates the social contract to the church? Religion is private and personal, hence the personal morality expressed to oneself within one's social contract need not necessarily be shared. But if you do choose to share, then share it in the context of a respectful adult-to-adult communication with church officers, not in the context of a submissive worthiness interview, and not in the context of a church court of excommunication. Who enforces the social contract? You do. You formed it. You hold the church accountable through your gifts and offerings of time and money. Reestablishing the balance of power. Milton Mayer argues in his book on Liberty, Man versus the State, that even liberal democratic governments must ultimately make their survival first priority. Treason is a high crime. Few people who govern nations or churches have enough integrity to voluntarily give up power. The American Civil War started because the federal government forcefully denied a state the right to secede from the Union. However, there are exceptions. Mikhail Gorbachev of the former Soviet Union is a remarkably principled statesman because he held to the use of persuasion, not military force, while the Baltic republics seceded. Church leaders have made a mistake of insisting the truth of their religion depends entirely on the factual truth of their historical claims. The truth of those claims is held to be absolutely crucial. This is the position in which the church has, by its own official pronouncements, voluntarily placed itself. Then, if not true, should the church be dissolved? Yes, by its own pronouncements, the truth claims are crucial. Could it be dissolved? No, not easily. Mormonism is more than its dogmatic claims to being right. It is a community of human relationships, shared values, ethics of virtue, institutional wealth, and a physical presence that will not vanish. The only practical approach is to reform itself from within, as Gorbachev initiated in the Soviet Union, and as did Mormonism's cousin, the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the RLDS. The RLDS Church chose to face up to the facts of Joseph's polygamy, acknowledge the Book of Mormon's problems, and downgrade the book's status, include women in its priesthood, stop its condemnation of homosexuality, and forego its exclusive claims to priesthood power. Mormonism should do the same. The power of religious organizations is maintained by the cooperation of its members. Claim your power. A person who can be given their freedom doesn't have it to begin with. Take it. Some members must argue for a change from within the church. First, we must argue for the right to argue freely and publicly. We commit homicide against the self when we deliver our authority to others, to the church, to a political party, to a creed, who advise us what our experience of joy and the meaning of our lives should be. Having abdicated our own authority, what is left of us? And that was a quote from Jerry Spence. Some of us must sacrifice membership to argue for change from outside the church. As Spence says, we may have an obligation to argue directly into the face of prejudice, even when there is no chance to win. If someone argues that women, because of their emotional nature, are less qualified than men to hold responsible positions, or because God is opposed, we incur an obligation to ourselves, the duty to argue against that prejudice with all our might and power, whether we win or not. It is a curious sight, he says, we ourselves locked in our closets with the key to our freedom clasped tightly in our fist. The key, of course, is permission, our permission, to peer out of the closets, to ask questions, to demand respect, to share our creativity, our ideas, to speak out, to search for love, and to seek justice. The passing of public figures, friends and family from the generation preceding mine are frequent reminders to me that my time is coming too. Long ago, I contemplated for myself the eternal implications, if any, of risking my own self-definition to live freely and authentically rather than in submission. I choose to speak publicly my conscience. I speak to prophet, king, God, or devil. These rights of personhood are what I think is good. Thank you.
Well, I thank Francis Nelson Henderson for his meaty contribution to the ongoing discussion of authoritarianism that has been taking place at Sunstone for the past 2 decades, at least. Much of what he has to say works nicely with what I've been studying in my review of how propaganda and scripture sometimes take the same path. By scripture, I also include religious discourse. Sometimes we don't make a clear distinction between those. Churches are institutions that don't live well unless they can persuade the members to participate, and so they are vulnerable to the use of propaganda to keep members in check. Let me just read to you the definition of propaganda, or one of them. Propaganda is the deliberate and systematic attempt to shape perceptions, manipulate cognitions, and direct behavior to achieve a response that furthers the desired intent of the propagandist. It is a neutral set of techniques capable of serving good or bad ends. In his discussion of the social contract, in which Francis Nelson Henderson really identifies the personal responsibility of each member of the church to have a knowledge of what happens when we stop being operated by our internal truths and allow ourselves to be operated upon by an institution. And as Jerry Spence said, and I quote from Nelson's speech, or is it Francis?
I go by Nelson.
Oh, Nelson, and from Nelson's speech, having abdicated authority, what is left of us. It's a serious issue in terms of salvation. If we are saved and leave nothing of ourselves to take to heaven, what have we? And I think this underlines the importance of what has been said here today. Propaganda theorist Jacques Ellul said this about propaganda. The propagandee is by no means just an innocent victim. He provides the psychological action of propaganda and not merely leads himself to it, but even derives satisfaction from it. Without his previous implicit consent, without this need for propaganda experienced by practically every citizen of this age, propaganda could not spread. There is not just a wicked propagandist at work who sets up means to ensnare the innocent citizen. Rather, there is a citizen who craves propaganda from the bottom of his being, and a propagandist who responds to this craving. Propagandists would not exist without the potential propagandees to begin with. To understand that propaganda is not just a deliberate and more or less arbitrary creation by some people in power is therefore essential. And so, Nelson's ideas are not alone. They are supported by at least one other field, and that is that to be fully human is to begin to distinguish between truth and things that are not true, sometimes propaganda. Sometimes simple things, the difference between the Christians saying, love one another as I have loved you, and a statement such as, follow the brethren. The two have different weights in terms of what they offer to us in terms of spiritual nutrition. One offers nothing. The other opens doors beyond our comprehension of potentiality. The bottom line is, if we cannot make decisions about whether an authoritative church statement is worth our support or not, on what basis do we have a testimony in the first place? And I give credit to that statement to Levina, who happens by coincidence to be sitting in the front row and is going, looking a bit quizzical. Levina, you said something like this in an interview. Well, you said it actually far more eloquently. If I could have quoted you directly, I would have. But you said that in an interview, I believe, with Rod Decker after your excommunication. And he questioned you on whether you were being consistent to your faithfulness to the church by questioning church leaders on true history issues. And this is what you said, and I repeat, if we can't make decisions about what an authoritative church statement is worth, whether that is worthy of our support or not, how can we, on what basis, really, do we declare that we have a testimony? So we have to take some authority for what we say, or there's nothing ultimately to save. And just to sum up my remarks, I wanted to bring up a juicy gem that dropped into my lap 2 days ago on Yahoo News, and that is an example of the vision of taking personal authority within an institution and against an institution's current policies and practices and doctrines that is occurring outside of Mormonism, and that is the 9 North American nuns who took priesthood upon themselves a few days ago. Let me just read part of this news release to you. 9 North American women sailed onto the St. Lawrence River to take part in an unauthorized ordination ceremony, risking excommunication by the Vatican to become priests and deacons. Dana Reynolds, Kathleen Strack, Rebecca MacGyver, Regina Nicolosi and Kathleen Vandenberg were named deacons by three female bishops who claimed to have themselves been anointed secretly by their male counterparts previously in a traditional Roman Catholic ordination ceremony aboard the Thousand Islander III, which usually ferries tourists around the picturesque Thousand Islands regions in eastern Canada. Wearing white robes with handmade silk stoles, white for priests, blue for deacons, the nine women sang hymns and listened to the liturgy laid on the boat deck as it rocked gently in the waves and had hands laid upon them. They were joined by some 260 friends and relatives who eagerly and patiently waited under a hot sun to board the boat, having their bags checked first by security, as awestruck tourists and cottagers looked on, some of them cheering. 14 women had already been anointed in similar river ceremonies in Europe in recent years, and 65 more, are hoping to join their ranks soon, but the ordinations are not sanctioned by the Vatican. The first seven women who ignored church doctrine against women priests and were ordained on the Danube River between Germany and Austria in 2002 were excommunicated by then Cardinal Ratzinger, now Pope, after they refused to retract their vows. Five of them attended the North American ceremony Monday. Our ship will sail through some stormy weather, but it will not go down, echoed woman bishop Patricia Frezen. In the meantime, the group will not divulge the names of the supporters within the church, fearing they will be excommunicated too. What's interesting about this is that it's not unprecedented within Mormonism. During the years before the black priesthood denial was lifted, one member of the church at least ordained a black man to the priesthood in this same kind of personal responsibility to be the Christian they wanted to be. And so I conclude simply by leaving this image before you. I think Francis Nelson Henderson has fulfilled the role of a prophet. He has spoken prophetically because he has given you a vision of what it is to be a true Christian within an institution and what is required. And without a vision, the people perish.
We have 2 minutes, so if someone has a very direct question that will allow a very clear, short response, we'll be glad to take maybe one quickly. Yes, do you want to repeat? Do it into the mic. It saves time.
Near the end of your paper, you mentioned you have a prescriptive sort of strategy for communicating expectations to the institution, your expectations of an appropriate social contract. And you mentioned specifically that it shouldn't be done in a submissive worthiness interview or in, what was the
church
other,
court
in a church court of excommunication. I was wondering what the appropriate context would be and why the advice to not use either of those venues.
Well, I do not believe in submission. I think that the argument that I'm making in this paper is to claim your power as an individual, your rights, your privilege, your power to define those. Put them in writing, perhaps. This talk did not discuss where to go next, where to go. There's no time. It's 45 minutes, 48 minutes. No time to talk about where does an individual go from here. So I tried to touch on that briefly. I feel it defeats the whole purpose of a social contract if then you go and ask permission of a church leader, someone to approve it or to bless it or say that it's okay. No, you stand up for yourself. And these are principles that you are defining for yourself that are core, that are not negotiable. And so if you go into a worthiness interview, you are submitting and you're on other turf. And you're not on your turf, and you need, I feel, to hold these concepts, your inherent dignity and your freedoms and your rights do not require anyone else's blessing or permission. And so I didn't want people, church members, to put themselves in a posture where they were defeating the very thing that they were trying to establish by the creation of the social contract.
All right. Thank you very much for attending. That concludes the session.